Talk given Friday, 18th May 1973. One sometimes hears that the great value, the transcendent value of love does not find a sufficiently strong place in the Upanishadic teachings, and also perhaps in certain ways in the Buddhistic teachings. It must be borne in mind that the Holy Ones give their teaching at a transcendent level. And what they have taught in connection with this value, one of the supreme values in the life of man, the value which redeems him in the most extraordinary way, this value has been taught transcendentally, but the language in which it is cast is such that it is quite easy not to notice just what is present in the Upanishads. You may recall that some time back I read you a little bit of that wonderful discourse by Yajnavalkya to Maitreyi, his wife, when he was about to give up the home life altogether and wander in the forest for the rest of his days. By this time he must have probably been somewhere near 60 years of age. And so, having meditated upon it and made the decision, he announces to his two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani, the Mary and the Martha of that period. This is what the Upanishad says. It's in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Now then, Yajnavalkya had two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani. Of the two, Maitreyi was a discourser on sacred knowledge. Katyayani had just a woman's knowledge in that matter. Yajnavalkya was about to commence another mode of life. Maitreyi, said Yajnavalkya, I am about to wander forth from this state. Behold, let me make a final settlement for you and Katyayani. That means distribute his goods. Then spake Maitreyi, if now, sir, this whole earth filled with wealth were mine, would I now thereby be immortal? No, no, said Yajnavalkya, as the life of the rich, even so would your life be. Of immortality, however, there is no hope through wealth. Then spake Maitreyi, what should I do with that through which I may not be immortal? What you know, sir, That indeed explained to me. Then spake Yajnavalkya, though verily you, my lady, were dear to us, you have increased your dearness. Behold then, I will explain it to you. But while I am expounding, do you seek to ponder thereon? Then spake he. Here follows the extraordinary discourse. Lo, verily, not for love of the husband is a husband dear, but for love of the Atma a husband is dear. Verily, not for love of the wife is a wife dear, but for love of the Atma a wife is dear. And he repeats that in connection with wealth, cattle, Brahmanhood, Kshatrahood, that is, you know, belonging to the Kshatriya caste, the worlds. He says, lo, verily, not for the love of the worlds are the worlds dear, but for love of the Atma, the worlds are dear. Then, the same with the gods. Then with the Vedas. Then with beings. And finally, as far as that list goes, lo, verily, not for love of all is all dear, but for love of the Atma, all is dear. He perhaps ought to have translated the all. Lo, it is the Atma that should be seen, that should be hearkened to, that should be thought on, that should be pondered on, actually meditated upon. And meditation in its profoundest sense means communion, the state of communion, of realized transcendence. Lo, in the soul's being seen, of course the soul is used by Hume to translate it, but I am trying to remember to say Atma, which is in the text. In that Atma being seen, hearkened to, thought on, understood, this world all is known. Now follows a very significant statement. Brahmanhood deserts him who knows Brahmanhood in aught else than the Atma. Then the same is repeated with regard to Kshatrahood, the worlds, the gods, the Vedas, beings. Everything deserts him who knows everything in aught else than the Atma. This Brahmanhood, Kshatrahood, worlds, gods, Vedas, all these beings, everything here is what this Atma is. Let us look at this. As it stands, it's not specially illuminating apart from just making a categorical statement, repeating the same formula and just substituting another word at the next repetition for the previous word. Brahman and Atma are an identity for the Upanishads. From the subjective angle, the angle which considers reality from the, shall I say, the life side, the personal consciousness side, the term Atma is used. Looked at objectively, scientifically, so to say, the term Brahman is used. Not for love of the husband and the wife are the husband and wife dear. Let us look at the origin of husband and of wife in this context. If we look at it literally as it stands, it's a pretty obvious thing. There is really no special reason why he who was called the Yogeshwara, the prince of yogis, should have talked almost platitudinously to his wife, who was a profoundly developed person, highly developed person. This husband and this wife refers, in the first instance, to something which lies at the very origin of all things. In the previous chapter of this Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there is a section. I have often quoted this to you, but bear with me for a while. In the beginning, this world was Atma alone, in the form of a person. And then he explains the meaning of the word person. Purusha is the word for person. Why is the Atma called Purusha? As the explanation goes, because formerly, Purva, he burnt out all evil-mindedness, Papmanam, Sarvam Papmanam, and burnt out, the root is Ush, Purva, Pur, Ush. So whoever has done that is to be called a Purusha. Now remember again that all the deep teachings of the scriptures have been written by you, by me. I'm just using you and me as standing for mankind, that's all. Those who realized it was men who wrote all this. What made them write it? Was it intellectual genius? Was it speculative philosophy? Was it a viewpoint which attracted them and therefore they built up a logical, philosophic system out of it? Not at all. You can completely put that right aside, altogether, where the scriptures are concerned. Here were men who, having realized that state of complete purity, first and foremost, as the foundation, who had developed the power of entering into the ultimate samadhi, the state of communion with the one total reality, returning back from that state, used this language in order to express how the return journey by consciousness changed from the awareness of the unitary wholeness, the one, into the many. This is the real meaning of all the creation accounts in all the scriptures. It has nothing to do with the evolution of galaxies and the generation and evolution of the trees and plants and animal species on the planet and so forth and so forth. Nothing to do with all that. It's the story of your consciousness coming back from that supreme state of communion possible to any human being, beyond which one can't go. Then what emerges in consciousness is presented in this form. Now, actually what emerges in consciousness is the experiencing of the transcendent energies of pure mind in operation, which are formless, nameless, shapeless. But their effect upon the person is of this, that, and the other nature. And these varieties of impression upon the whole psychophysical being is given the names of archangels, angels, the demonic forces, that is to say the catabolic forces, as contrasted with the anabolic forces, which actually are at play everywhere. Now, what sort of names will they give? What sort of description will they give? The only material they have at hand is their own mythological cultural heritage. Otherwise, all of them would necessarily give the identical account, whether they were in India, China, Arabia, Timbuktu, or anywhere. But the accounts are not identical because the mental verbal, the intellectual verbal material which they were acquainted with was characteristic of their particular culture. Now, in addition to that, there are certain things which are common to all mankind. We all experience hunger. We all breathe. We all eat, drink, sleep. We all marry. There are two sexes. There are children, and so forth. There are certain things which are universal to all, whatever your origin, your cultural, your racial origin may be. But all the other elements are conditioned by the particular cultural heritage that has come down according to the society to which we belong. Now, we being men and women, human creatures, naturally talk of that supremely purified state, the one in which all evil-mindedness is burnt out, as representing a person. We can't say in the form of a dog, or a hippopotamus, or a pterodactyl or something, can we? We must of necessity say a person. What other word can we use? This is universal to mankind. Hence, in the beginning, this world meaning the totality, whatever that totality is, and with special reference to the state in which the man in supreme samadhi experienced these things, that world, which is here and now, of course, all the time. Try and follow this carefully, because if you really get into it, heaps and heaps of unnecessary speculative thought and so on will just vanish. Leave the mind free. The freedom of the mind depends upon understanding these things at their transcendent level. So now, the Purusha is present to start with. Then it goes on to say he was afraid, and then he resolves that fear because he says he sees there is nothing else to be afraid of. In that transcendent state, which is the unitary wholeness state, he says, I am. See? The unitary wholeness, that's all there is. Well, if there is nothing which is other than oneself, which could possibly be antagonistic, there is no cause for fear. Then the next verse states, verily he had no delight. Now listen very carefully. He was indeed as large as a woman and a man closely embraced. Now obviously this is not physical. He caused that self to fall apart into two pieces. Therefrom arose a husband and a wife. The root of the Sanskrit verb to fall apart is pat. And pati is the name, is the word used to designate the masculine after falling apart, the husband, and patni to designate the wife. Now, recall Genesis, first chapter. And Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. Male, female, made he them. Each one is male, female. But what Elohim made, it is translated as God in the Bible, unfortunately. They should have left the original names. What Elohim made is at the transcendent level. So you see, this primordial energy is dual in nature, positive-negative. If it was not dual in this sense of positive-negative, process cannot set in. Nothing would happen. Right at the transcendent level then, the holy ones, emerging slowly from that transcendent condition, presented the activity of transcendence in terms of the male-female, positive-negative. In those days, there was no possibility of their using the terms positive-negative, for the simple reason that these terms to us mean what they mean to modern science. The positive and negative poles of electricity or of a magnet and so forth. This is what we mean, essentially, because these are forces which we can handle. And we know about them. So we use the terms positive, negative. They use the terms male, female, which is the identical thing, really. Right. So now, returning from that state of consciousness, of course it is put in a rather crude picturization, isn't it? He was as large as a man and a woman closely embraced. I think that in the Kabbalah they present the man, and the term Adam is a generic term which means man, and the woman, Isha, are side by side. They are not facing each other. They are side by side. And then the separation takes place afterwards that way. It's very interesting. But here it just says, a woman and a man closely embraced. He caused that self to fall into two pieces. Well, obviously he can't cause it, but they had no other way of writing it in those days. When you return from that state of awareness, gradually this sort of separation into two just takes place in awareness. You become aware of the male aspect of energy interplaying with the female aspect of energy universally. Whatever the plane you're referring to, whether it be the transcendent level, the mental level, or the physical level. And so, husband and wife come into being this way. Separation has taken place. Now, you see, we are proliferating from unitary wholeness into manyness. Therefore, this is true. As Yajnavalkya used to say, oneself is like a half fragment. That is to say, the separate self that we are conscious of in terms of our own sex and our own being is like a half fragment. Now, there is something which, as far as I am aware, is missed out in actual statement. We are a double duality. We are a duality transcendentally, right at the Elohimic level, right at this Atmic level, and here now, in our very bodies, in our psychophysical beings, we are male-female also. You see? This is something which is of extreme importance. The female, at the transcendent level, is the holder of the creative energy which brings us into existence, which draws us back to transcendence, doesn't let us go to the devil. The female, at the physical level, originates from earth itself. The earth female is moved by desire, concupiscence, and so forth. She is merely a proliferator, promiscuous, only concerned with keeping the stream of life going, separate lives coming to existence, not concerned with that release of transcendent awareness which the heavenly female is concerned with. I'm still talking in symbolic terms, but what other terms can I talk in? You see? Now, the husband and wife referred to by Yajnavalkya in that discourse to Maitreya is fundamentally that husband and that wife. At the psychophysical level of the existent being Yajnavalkya and the existent being Maitreya, well, obviously Maitreya knew all this because she was the devoted wife of her husband. And that was that. There was no need to say such a thing. But it is this which he refers to. Really. Now, Let me read what I have written here. Transcendence, heaven and earth are in timeless conjugation, in an everlasting interplay, a creative interplay, which is consequenceless. There is no, meaning this, that there is no retributive karma involved in it. The Holy One's awareness of this in communion, he translates as world creation. In ancient days, this was spoken of in the common terms of common creatures, exoterically. The few learned and discovered the inner meaning. Now, he verily had no delight, as that's this verse here. And the Sanskrit is Savai Naiva Reme. Therefore, one who is alone has no delight. Now this is speaking analogically from our physical world experience. He desired a second. See, that's how it goes. He desired a second. He was indeed as large as a woman and a man close conjoined. He caused that very being, evatmanam, is the Sanskrit, to fall into two parts. He had no delight, he desired a second. From that arose, now, I'm using the term sovereign lord, pati. Pati is Lord also. Like the husband is regarded as Lord and Master. A sovereign Lord, Pati, meaning a husband. And the lady, Patni, a wife. The sovereign Lord and the sovereign lady. Now I've deliberately given this translation because it distinguishes the plane on which this takes place. Otherwise, after all, even an intellectually developed person would say, oh, what's all this? It's rather naive sex and primitive this, that and the other. Nothing to do with it. This sovereign lordship, because there is power being utilized, being controlled by the Holy One in these stages. When you, in meditation, enter into any of these really deep states, don't mistake all the exalted and passing the passing play of mental conditions, however exalted, however attractive and wonderful, for these very deep states. You leave all that behind. Then, when you're dealing with power like that, you realize the meaning of the sovereign lord and the sovereign lady. Therefore, oneself is like a half fragment, as Yajnavalkya used to say. Therefore, this void, that is actually in the Upanishad, this void, akasha, is filled with the feminine. Now remember, akasha, I have said this often, should be understood as mind space. Mind space has no dimensions, no length, breadth, depth. It's not measurable. You're dealing with the immeasurable. Therefore, this mind space is filled with the feminine. Very significant. And it is this transcendent feminine who holds the secret of creative energy in itself. Look at the peculiar, correspondence, if I may use that word. In the atom, it is not the proton, the positively charged part, which matters. It's the electron, the negative charge. It's the electron, the female in the story, who runs around the proton. It is that which determines the properties and energies and chemical activities of that particular element. It's the electrons which determine all that. The females, not the male protons, which only are tightly packed together at the center in the nucleus. It's a fascinating thing, isn't it? Even at the physical level, modern science discovers this, and 30 centuries ago, the Upanishadic teachers spoke like this. He, the sovereign lord, conjugated with her, the lady. Therefrom were produced beings with intelligence, manushya. Now you see, take a passage like this, and if you can remember what I've tried to put before you just now, very haltingly tried, it's not easy to talk about. If you do that, you will discover all kinds of extraordinary things. Here, the intellect, if it remains quiet and poised, can really penetrate into the meanings, the inner meanings, in terms of the actual play of real energies within your own being. So this transcendent male, the sovereign lord, conjugated with the lady, and therefrom were produced beings with intelligence. And the word is manushya, that is, men and women. We, you and I, as we are, psychophysical creatures, existence, living existence, TENTS, are beings with intelligence. They were produced by that conjugation. Now that is the real creative level. From thence onwards, the transcendent level is left behind, so to say. Now we are in the non-transcendent level. We can't create like that as psychophysical existence. We procreate, which is a different thing. At that level, there isn't the concreteness, at the transcendent level, there is not the concreteness of what we call matter, the senses and the mind, discursive mind in operation. When we lose a dimension or two in that transcendent state, then we come to other state, even in our deepest meditation in the ordinary way. It's only when you get to that state of meditation where it is really the meditation of the Holy One. If you use Christian terms, Jesus communing with the Father. I would not tell you this if the Father had not told me, etc., etc. You know, that kind of thing. We lose that dimension, and we do not possess that creative power anymore. Here, we have only one creative power, which is not a positive act of creation by us knowingly. It just happens in procreation. It may not come off. It works, it doesn't work. That is to say, our capacity to conjugate, a man and a woman to conjugate and produce living beings, is a case where we are merely a tool for something which we know nothing about. Have you got that? Now you see, this is the serpent of the Garden of Eden, amongst many other things. The serpent symbolizes so many things. Very generally, the life force, in the psychophysical sense, Bernard Shaw's sense, in Freud's sense, and all the rest of it. Now, the phallus is all that a man has to utilize in order to bring forth another human being. But he forgets. He thinks that he is bringing it forth in cooperation with his wife. He forgets, and she forgets, that they are only the tools of something which is very much outside their awareness altogether. Otherwise it would come off exactly as they willed. You see, even the Buddha gives a peculiar hint when he says to the monks, if your body were the Atta, then you could wish it to be thus and thus, and it would be thus and thus, but it isn't. You can't bring it about like that. And the same with the feelings. The same with the sankhara, the sannya, the vedana, the vijnana even, you see. So the entire psychophysical existence sphere is one which does not have this creative power, which is the prerogative of divinity, of the Holy One in the supreme state of communion. Now, this creative process at the transcendent level has no concupiscence in it. The energies are not desire-driven. There is no pleasure, no sensation involved in it. It is pure creative activity, just like that. This is the origin of love. And you see, in the beginning was the Atma alone in the form of the person. And out of that, all these statements come and emerge. So there's that primordial source, which is the origin of love. Similarly, it is the origin of wisdom, beauty, goodness, truth, anything and everything.
Is there being in
this? You can use the word being, of course. Because the one total reality remains the one total reality, whatsoever transformations and changes go on with respect to the particulars. Now, I'm always faced with this difficulty linguistically. When I talk about one total reality, and I also use the term the many, the multitudinous variety, the particulars, it is so natural because we are conditioned like that by virtue of our sense-mind experience. We think in terms of separate objects which are all added together to make up the totality. Not at all. This is the great mystery. This you will experience in deep consciousness, very, very deep consciousness. The totality is the particular, and the particular is totality. This in Zen you get stated. But it's a literal fact at a transcendent level. How and why are there multitudinous particulars in the way in which we are conscious of them? The reason is because this psychophysical organism is constituted this way and can function only thus and thus. It is like a receptive set, you see. It's like a machine, a receiving machine. And it can receive only thus and thus and give you thus, this and that result in consequence of the reception. It is only when the person himself is able to pacify the normal activities of the psychophysical organism and be able to enter into what is called the void, this mind space which has no dimensions, the manyness vanishes. That is to say, the conditioning caused by the manyness, the illusion caused by the manyness, that they are all separate particulars and you can't see the relationships between them, that vanishes. But in that state, you can't deal with the separate particulars as you do at our everyday worldly level. You can't have it both ways as far as actual dealing with them is concerned. One is the story of consciousness, the other is the story of the limitations of the psychophysical existent in interaction with all the particulars around him. Right. Yes, but the form in which that truth will manifest and work is quite different. This is where the variety comes. This is where the variety comes, you see. But I've been trying to point out the transcendent origin of love. Not for love of the husband, is the husband dear, but for love of the Atma. Because that is the absolute holder of everything. The very word Atma, I have always translated as the eater up. Not soul or self or any such puerile translation. That's hopeless. The Atma is the eater up. And I'll tell you why and how I came to that conclusion. When you go into the deep states of meditation, you'll find that all the particular thought forms which clutter your consciousness content, you see, vanish away. Every one of them disappears. When there is the complete denudation, there is utter transparency. Your mind has become light itself. You do not obtain light into the mind. Your mind itself becomes the light, and it throws that light outside, it radiates it away from you. Your mind is, to use the word in which is used so much in Buddhism, is empty. That is the meaning of the void. But it is in the state of pure mind itself then. Consciousness is completely unobstructed. It is utterly clean. There is not the slightest besmirchment of consciousness then. Now, this denudation process, therefore, and it is that state which to which the word Atma applies. The Atma is not a subject, a soul, an entity. It refers to the state which prevails when you yourself, utterly pure, utterly still and silent, infinitely resilient, are the focus into which transcendent energy flows and goes out absolutely unhindered. This is the point. Now it is that state which is the Atma. To which the word Atma applies. You see? So in the beginning is a very bad phrase, but there is no escaping that. You see? Because the timeless is brought into the realm of time. In the beginning, that. Which means that you are in that state. Now from that state coming back, how do these energies, these transcendent energies play? And look at the word that is used here. Naiva rene and na ramate. Delight, he had no delight in the sense of play. You see, it means play. And play means interplay and interaction. Otherwise there's no play. It takes two to play a game. And so forth. So the Atma is the eater up of what we commonly call the mind. When we say mind, we mean all the mental content. Our thoughts, feelings, ideas, beliefs, convictions, knowledge, memories, all that. That is what we mean by mind. All that is completely eaten up. Long after I had sort of come to this conclusion that is a good way of regarding the Atma, I discovered that Madhvacharya, I think, quotes Shankara as having used same idea regarding the Atma as the eater up. So now, oh dear. No, that's all right. Now, in the static undivided, when the sovereign lord and lady are just one, there is no creative action. Wisdom by itself is non-moving. It lives only through love. Without wisdom, joy of love degenerates into destructive lust. Now that is what has happened to the human race. You see, for innumerable millennia, the phallus has dominated man's drives, his activities, and so forth. Then, with the development of civilization, the brain acts like a phallus. Your artists, your scientists, your philosophers, your etc., you see, the brain is used there. And they say, well, you say when a man writes a work of music or produces a statue, you say he has created it, don't you? He has procreated, really. He has ejected out of his this phallus, the brain. When a man takes a pen and writes, he's using the pen as a tool, which is the phallus in this case, for the productive work. Or perhaps a better example is the painter with his brush. You see? The phallic symbolism is a very remarkable symbolism altogether. It's a pure thing. It's a wonderful thing. This is why the plucking of the fruit in the Garden of Eden became a necessity in order that the heavenly female could triumph over the earthly female. In order that the power of sex, if understood fully, could be transcended and this other aspect could come into action in man's life, which enables him to undergo the purification and to realize the samadhi, which takes him into that state of communion. You see, this business of celibacy has been terribly misunderstood. All along the line, it has been terribly misunderstood. When you have seen into it properly, you will find that the sexual energies, the physical sexual energies of their own accord will become quiescent. They'll be pacified. And that psychophysical energy, which expresses itself as the sexual urge, the sexual drive, and so forth, just naturally now manifests in different ways. It goes through the stages of cultural expression in all its in all forms of the word culture, and in finality, this is one of the special things about yoga, in finality it is the energy which enables Shakti, power, coiled up at the base of the spine, to unite with her lord Shiva, the brain. At the brain level. You see? But this is what actually happens to the Holy One in the state of supreme samadhi. These things are very deep and they are so unknown. Now, in the terms of Hatha Yoga, of Kundalini Yoga and so forth, this is the supreme love. Shiva, the unmoving one. Shakti is not driven by desire, but by aspiration. She aspires to union with her Lord, to return to that primordial state, no longer in a condition of blissful unconsciousness, but of blissful, completely awakened and enlightened awareness. as long as the individual human being in the world is not interested in these things, or has no use for them, or approaches them in the wrong spirit, to attain, to gain, and all the rest of the rubbish, the reality is out. The fundamental purification is this complete liberation from all selfness. And when that is there, these transcendent things can be realized by you yourself in consciousness.